The movie Napoleon, directed by Ridley Scott and starring Joaquin Phoenix, opened just before Thanksgiving, and it's been highly criticized by historians. So come on, guys. You know our program. You know me. You knew that sooner or later, I was going to peel the history behind this film.
And he's reviewed the different Napoleons, and he finds the Joaquin Phoenix Napoleon to be absolutely like bottom of the barrel.
Oh, boy.
Very unconvincing, just strangely unconvincing.
I'm trying to make sense of this, Dr. Blaufarb. How does he rise into power? I mean, it's so unlikely.
Well, it's extremely unlikely. The key thing I think that we have to keep in mind is that Napoleon rose to power through politics, the politics of the French Revolution. He did not rise to prominence because of exploits on the battlefield. In all respects, be exactly like the King of France, except that Napoleon outfoxes him. Napoleon, this shows what a political genius Napoleon was. He outfoxes the man who engineers the French Revolution and then kills the French Revolution. That's right. In fact, in countries like in England is this way for all of its moderate government and liberty. England to this very day, in England, the only person who is considered to be a full property owner in England right now is the monarch.
That's funny because he became an authoritarian leader.
But equality and authoritarianism go together very nicely. The thing that
they do
very much.
Okay, so technologically, it was precedented. Was the scale of the warfare unprecedented?
That's what's unprecedented. The number of soldiers involved in these wars was far more than Europe and possibly anywhere in the world up to that point had ever seen. These are probably the Napoleonic Wars are, I believe, the largest wars in human history until World War I. He was actually legally French, but just barely. That's the short answer. The long answer is, what do you mean by French?
Did you know that Napoleon was born only a year after his homeland, Corsica, was conquered by France, and that at the time of his birth, his father was fighting with the Corsican army against the French? And get this, when Napoleon moved to France around the age of 10, this future emperor of the French could not yet speak French. Hey there, news peelers. Today's Wednesday, January 17, 2024, and this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink or both and let's get into it. When a buddy of mine told me that a new Napoleon movie was coming out, I immediately asked him, "Who's playing Napoleon?" Now, that's not a strange question to ask at all. We ask that sort of question for just about any movie, right? But in my case, I didn't ask the question out of interest. I asked it out of concern. You see, from my perspective, there are two issues here. First, Napoleon is a complex character. And as my guest, Dr. Rafe Blaufarb, explains, that complexity is further complicated by Napoleon's own propaganda and myth-making about himself. So it would be hard for any actor, including Mr. Joaquin Phoenix, to do justice to Napoleon. Second, I was also concerned because of my sensitivity toward French history. Here, to be sure, Sir Ridley Scott, the British director and producer of this film, is highly accomplished, particularly in the genre of historical drama. But that hasn't stopped the French from lambasting the movie. According to the New York Times, French critics considered the movie, quote, lazy, pointless, boring, migraine-inducing, too short, and historically inaccurate, and that's just to start, end quote. With respect to the film being too short, for your information, the movie's 2 hours and 37 minutes. Le Figaro, the French newspaper, called the movie, quote, Barbie and Ken under the Empire, end quote. GQ's French edition described it as, quote, deeply clumsy, unnatural, and unintentionally funny, end quote. And in Le Point, a French weekly political news magazine, a leading historian called the movie, quote, very anti-French and very pro-British, end quote. I think you get the picture. So, to better understand Napoleon, his world, his unlikely rise to power, and his transformation of France in many ways, I spoke to Dr. Blaufarb of Florida State University. He's a professor of history, a Ben Weider eminent scholar of Napoleonic studies, and the director of the Institute on Napoleon and the French Revolution, a one-of-a-kind institute in the United States that we talk about in this episode. He's the author of many books, including the following. First, Napoleon, A Symbol for an Age. Second, The Revolutionary Atlantic, Republican Visions, 1760 to 1830. Third, The Great Demarcation, The French Revolution and the Invention of Modern Property. And fourth, The French Army, 1750 to 1820. Careers, Talent, Merit. To learn more about Dr. Blaufarb, you can visit his academic homepage, as well as the website for the Institute on Napoleon and the French Revolution, the links for which are provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Blaufarb and I peel the history behind this news. I'm excited to share with you the news that on January 25th, we will launch Unraveling the Middle East. It's a whole new weekly podcast, a series on the Middle East, its in-depth history and analysis. For example, one economic historian will answer this question, why Middle East economies fell behind Europe's. Another historian will explain the historical background to Yemen's war with Saudi Arabia and also the rise of Houthis. We always hear about the Middle East as being a troubled region, right? Well, in one episode, we go back to the very beginning, to ancient times, and examine how kings and emperors resolve international tensions, and we ask this question. Was the Middle East a troubled region then? As you will note in our program, this question is one that we will return to for different periods in the history of the Middle East. Before I let you go, here's one more example of an episode from Unraveling the Middle East podcast. Women's rights. We hear about this all the time with respect to the Middle East, so we're going to dig into this, starting with women of ancient Middle East, their power, their rights, their properties. I've dropped a link to Unraveling the Middle East in the detailed caption of this episode, so you can follow this program on your favorite podcast platform. Now, let's start our conversation with Dr. Blaufarb about Napoleon, the man, the general, the emperor, but most of all, the political genius. Dr. Blaufarb, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me. At the outset, would you please explain this point for our audience? Napoleon was and continues to be a national hero for the French. I get that. No problem. But was Napoleon, in fact, French?
Yeah, well, it, The short answer is, yes, he was French. He was born a subject of the French king by 1 year only. Had he been born a year earlier, he would not have been born French.
Wow. But
during his mother's pregnancy with him, the island of Corsica was conquered by France and surrendered to the armies of the French king and accepted the French king's sovereignty. And then Napoleon was born a few months later. So he was actually legally French, but just barely. That's the short answer. The long answer is, what do you mean by French?
Yeah.
The thing you have to understand is that the Kingdom of France before 1789, before the French Revolution, was composed of approximately 40 distinct provinces, each with their own laws, institutions, customs, and specific political relationship to the crown. So instead of thinking of France as a unified country, as a nation that was kind of laterally unified, think of it more like a bicycle wheel in which the king is the center holding 40 spokes together. And without the king, there is no political unity in France at all.
Dr. Blaufarb, when you talk about these 40 distinct provinces and the way you described it with their distinct legal system and administrative system, this doesn't sound like a kingdom anymore. This sounds like an empire, right? You almost have 40 different, almost like nations almost.
That's right. And those provinces indeed called themselves nations.
Oh, they did.
They did. The Corsican nation, the Provençal nation, the Breton nation. And in fact, the majority of people living in this decentralized kind of kingdom, this provincialized kingdom, the majority of people don't even speak French.
I'm sorry, say that again?
The majority of people in the kingdom don't speak French.
So in Brittany at that time, or I don't know, name any other province, they didn't necessarily speak French?
The vast majority, especially in Brittany, the vast majority of the two million or so inhabitants of Brittany did not speak French. The people who speak French are the elites. They tend to be what we would call, I guess, the bourgeoisie and the nobility and the clergy. The elites speak French. It's a kind of like state language. It's the language of royal government. And indeed, it's the language of government. It's the language of legal documents. But ordinary people, peasants who compose 85% of the population, most of them do not speak French. They speak Breton or Corsican in the case of where Napoleon was born, or they speak Occitan in the south of France, and we can go on and on and on.
do remnants of these languages exist? If we go to Corsica or Brittany, do we hear people still?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Especially those two provinces. So Corsica is the Corsican language, which is a variant. It's related to Italian. I'm not sure if it's considered a separate language or a dialect of Italian. It is widely, widely spoken. Corsicans speak Corsican at home to each other and in the streets to each other as well. French is for tourists and dealing with government bureaucrats.
Wow. This is so fascinating.
In Brittany, it's a bilingual like education system, kind of like in Quebec or maybe not Quebec, like Canada, I should say. Where Breton is widely taught alongside French, and there are, I think, something like 10% of Breton kids go to an all-Breton school. There are actual attempts to revive these languages.
Oh, wow. I don't think most Americans appreciate that diversity of cultures and languages in France. We just think of it as France, right? We don't think of it this way. Let's go back to a term that you used at the outset of our conversation. You said, yes, he's legally French. And I get that, within a year of his birth, or before his birth, Corsica is conquered by France, and it becomes legally part of the French kingdom. But if a person is legally part of a sovereignty, are they French at heart?
That's a great question. Well, let me answer that. Napoleon's family, his father and mother, they were Corsican nobles. They had a certain level of influence, particularly around the city of Ajaccio, and they had fought to keep Corsica independent. They had fought against the French.
Oh wow! But,
yes, they had, absolutely. When Napoleon's mother is pregnant with him, his father is off with the Corsican armies trying to drive away the French. Once Corsica surrendered, Corsicans had a choice. Do we make our peace with the new French order and try to get ahead in it? Or do we dig in our heels and become kind of, you know, lost cause, diehard rebels? Well, the Bonaparte family, Napoleon's father, Charles Bonaparte, and his wife, Letitia, they decide, you know what? We're going to accept reality, and we are going to make peace with France and try to get ahead by offering our influence as local notables to the new French government. They are rewarded for this by the French governor of the island. The entire Bonaparte family reaps many, many benefits from the French government, one of which is the young Napoleon is awarded a free, all tuition paid place in one of France's military preparatory schools. And that's why he goes off to France and eventually becomes an officer in the French king's armies.
From what you were saying earlier about languages, I'm now curious, Dr. Blafarb. Napoleon goes to France from Corsica, and Corsica is just above Sardinia, which continues to be Italian now. So he goes as a young person, even a boy, to France. Does he speak French?
No. When he leaves Corsica, he doesn't speak French. And in fact, before he lands in France, and before he's actually put in the military school, I believe he's given some crash courses in French, so he's not completely lost.
How old was he then?
I believe he was 8.
Oh my God! So
yeah, give or take a couple of years.
Yeah,
an 8, 9, something like that.
So the future emperor of France doesn't speak French as a youth. That's really interesting. So I'm trying to make sense of this, Dr. Blafarb. How does he rise to power? I mean, it's so unlikely.
Well, it's extremely unlikely. The key thing I think that we have to keep in mind is that Napoleon rose to power through politics,
and politics,
the politics of the French Revolution. He did not rise to prominence because of exploits on the battlefield. In fact, the first time Napoleon really served in a French army fighting on foreign soil against a regular foreign army at war with France was in 1796, when he was, I don't know, in his mid-20s. Until then, Napoleon's entire young early military career had been spent essentially repressing civil disorder within France and fighting using force in the context of France's revolutionary internal political struggles. He was a political general. He wasn't a battlefield general at all.
Oh, this is so interesting, because for most people, including I, we think of Napoleon as this, you know, military genius. His strategies are still taught in military schools. But you are not negating that necessarily. You're talking about his initial rise to power. This is a specific thing that you're talking about, right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So the French Revolution breaks out in 1789.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only in 1796 that he goes off to join one of France's regular field armies, the Army of Italy. Interestingly, he joins that army as its commander-in-chief. His first posting to essentially a regular fighting military force is as its commander-in-chief.
Wait, let me interrupt you here. And the reason I'm guessing here, correct me if I'm wrong. And the reason he's appointed to be the commander-in-chief, it's not because he's got decades of battle experience. It's because of politics, what you just said.
Yes. He had exactly, over the course of the revolution between 1789 and 1796, Napoleon had on several instances, each instance more important than the other, had proven his worth to the revolutionary regime in power as a kind of, you know, strongman, as the kind of armed force at the disposition of the revolutionary political leaders if they were being threatened with civil war and secession, as in the case of Toulon, the city that Napoleon reconquers for France at the end of 1793, a city that had risen up against the revolution, had welcomed in British troops to protect it. Well, Napoleon crushes that revolt. That's an internal revolt against the French Revolution. And later on, in 1795, he's going to put down a massive uprising of Paris, of the Parisian population against the revolutionary government that's ruling there. He literally protects it by surrounding its building, the government buildings, with cannon and delivering his famous whiff of grapeshot.
Yeah,
and
from
all of these services. For all of these services as a political general, as a kind of, you know, how should I put it, the sword of the political regime against its internal enemies, for all of his services in this regard, he is finally rewarded with command of an actual army, the Army of Italy. And that's the first time he shows up in the foreign war.
That is just really interesting. I'm going to make another guess, somewhat educated based on what you were saying. You said he crushes, you know, he crushed revolts, he suppressed massive uprisings, and there's, you know, I've read about this many times, he literally opens cannons on people. Do you think he was perhaps more ruthless and determined in crushing these uprisings than his counterparts that were, or his comrades that were actually born in France?
No, that's an interesting theory. I mean, certainly before Napoleon comes into the picture, when he's just a lowly lieutenant of artillery in 1789, when the revolution breaks out, there's a lot of obviously rather urban uprising in the capital, in Paris. You know,
yeah,
the people rise up and take the Bastille, and so they march on Paris, on Versailles in October, and so on and so forth. The royal government, in those instances of popular uprising, prefers to turn to foreign troops. About 25% of the French army in 1789 is composed of foreign regiments. And the particular regiments that are seen by the crown in 1789 as the specialists in putting down urban revolt and civilian dissent are the Swiss regiments. There are about 10 or 12 Swiss regiments who are serving on the French king under special contracts, and they are seen as totally obedient to their officers, totally cut off from the French population, subject to much harsher discipline than the normal French army, and they're seen as kind of like the royal government's police force, and they are deeply hated by the civilian population.
I think there's a monument to the several hundred Swiss guards that protected Louis XVI, and they were slaughtered by the French people. I think that monument is in Switzerland. I've read about it. You know, you and I could talk about Napoleon for hours on. He's a fascinating person, character. I've read many books that are biographies. If you just look behind me, most of these are actually biographies that make history into stories. When I was speaking with you prior to our podcast, you said you've had many requests. You've turned down many requests to write biographies of Napoleon. Why is that?
Well, first of all, to be accurate and modest, it wasn't many, but it was more than one request.
Okay, more than one. You are being modest. You're right.
And on top of that, it was at the time of the bicentennial of I guess when was it? It must have been around 2014 or so. The bicentennial of, you know, Napoleon's fall from power, Waterloo, all of that, and yeah. So all the publishers were looking to come out with Napoleon biographies, thinking that there would be a market for a general market for books on him. But I thought, no, I can't do this. There's several reasons why I can't do it. Mm-hmm. First, it has to do with me. I'm just not really good at reading the internal thoughts and sentiments of people who are dead, who died, you know, over two centuries ago. I just don't feel comfortable doing that. And in fact, it's, you know, it's hard enough to read the inner life, to know the inner life of anyone you meet on the street today, or even family members. People are complicated. And I would not even remotely presume to write a biography of anybody. Now, Napoleon is particularly frustrating, I find.
Uh-huh.
Because for several reasons. First of all, he was extremely careful to curate his public image.
Oh,
he was always aware. It particularly begins when he takes command of the Army of Italy. He always was very aware that how he was seen by the public, by the government, had a kind of political value. And so he deliberately shapes his image. For example, in 1796, when he's commanding the Army of Italy, he uses his own money to publish two army newspapers that are sent back to France, that are circulated in France, that do nothing but proclaim what a great military genius he is.
He was
a propagandist for himself, always. And as he goes on in life, as he becomes more powerful, as he becomes first consul, then emperor, it gets even more extreme. So Napoleon, the expressions of Napoleon's thinking that we have are extremely oriented toward massaging his public opinion. They are not. We have no intimate diary of Napoleon. We don't have personal letters of Napoleon. We've got a lot of kind of business letters, but not really the kinds of things that, in my opinion, would allow us to really get at his internal being.
Interesting. So it's not like looking at the correspondence between Abigail and John Adams to see what they're really like in person, or Washington's, or anything like that, George. That's really fascinating. We'll be back after a short break to talk about how Napoleon changed France. Wow, propaganda.
I'm telling you, the man was a political animal. That's where he lived. He did not live in his sentiments. I don't think he cared about it. He was an extremely political guy, but he had a lot more. But because he was so political, because he was so focused on presenting a certain image of himself, he had a whole lot more charisma than Joaquin Phoenix projects in that movie, you know.
If you're even marginally aware of major events in other countries, I've got a question for you.
In your lifetime, how many times have you heard of mass protests in France? Now, compare that to how many times you've heard of mass protests in other European countries, especially in Western Europe. Okay, this was a rhetorical question, so I'll give you the answer myself. More. Way more. We more frequently hear about street protests in France than many other countries. Last year was the pension protest when France changed its pension eligibility age from 62 to 64. These were protests that lasted about 3 months and just about paralyzed France. In 2019, it was the Yellow Vest protest, which had similar impact, and there were others in recent years and decades. So to better understand the history of French rebellions, revolts, and revolutions, I spoke with Professor Robert Gilday of Oxford University, who shared this with me about the final article of the 1793 French Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen. Quote, "When the government violates the rights of the people, insurrection is for the people and each part of the people the most sacred of rights and the most indispensable of duties." End quote. Yes. That word you heard was, in fact, insurrection. I've dropped a link for you to my conversation with Professor Gilday in Season 3, Episode 13. It's an absolutely fantastic conversation, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it too. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Blaufarb about Napoleon. Dr. Blaufarb, how did Napoleon change France?
That's the big question. I think it really begins with his seizure of power in 1799 and the first couple years of his time as first consul following that seizure of power. The main thing Napoleon does, the most important thing he does, the thing on which everything else rests, including his ability to remain in power for the next 15 years, is he is able to end the French Revolution. He is able to end the disorders and conflicts of the French Revolution, while at the same time preserving, maintaining some of the revolution's principal gains, particularly the idea of equality before the law.
That's funny because he became an authoritarian leader.
But equality and authoritarianism go together very nicely. The thing that
they do
very much equality. This is Alexis de Tocqueville.
Yeah.
This was what he said this probably most persuasively of all. He said that equality actually is antithetical to liberty. There's a tension between equality and liberty. Liberty depends to an extent on inequality. But if you have a state in which everyone is absolutely equal before the law, that makes it much more easy for an authoritarian ruler in control of the government to impose his will on those people.
Wow. That's okay. That's like a whole podcast onto itself, Dr. Blaufarb. First of all, Alex de Tocqueville came to the U.S. and did a tour of our prison systems. I think, what was it, in the 1820s or something like that?
I think a little later, but yeah.
A little later. So he was not...
Before the Civil War, yeah.
Yeah, he was post-Napoleon. It's interesting that he says that. Let's go back. I'm purposefully not going to ask too many questions and follow up to that equality theme because that could be a whole different conversation onto itself. You said seizure of power, 1799. So did Napoleon stage a coup?
Yes, Napoleon comes to power in a coup d'état.
It's wow.
a planned seizure of power. He's not actually the guy who plans it. The person most responsible for planning this seizure of power is a fellow named Sieyès, a former priest, who had been a revolutionary in 1789. In fact, Sieyès is the man most responsible for the French Revolution of 1789. He is instrumental in creating the National Assembly and in giving that National Assembly the means of seizing power from the king and holding on to power. So in a way, this character, Sias, he engineers 1789, he engineers the revolution, and then 10 years later, disenchanted with what had happened, he engineers its overthrow. For Sias and his plot, Napoleon is simply the general they need. They need a bit of armed force just in case the legislature resists the transfer of power that Sias is trying to engineer. And Napoleon is just the general they managed to recruit.
The right instrument.
He was actually their second or third choice. They had approached other generals, some of whom had refused. One of them had said yes, but was then killed in battle. And so Napoleon is not even their first choice.
Oh, that, wow. Talk about sort of fate. So was Sias disenchanted once more when Napoleon declared himself emperor?
Yes. Well, the problem is Sias had a whole plan cooked up to essentially make himself, Sias, essentially a kind of king. The title he gave himself was Grand Elector of France, and he would live in the former royal palace, have 20 million pounds revenue every year, in all respects be exactly like the king of France, except that Napoleon outfoxes him. Napoleon, this shows what a political genius Napoleon was. He outfoxes the man who engineers the French Revolution and then kills the French Revolution. He outfoxes the guy. Wow. And Sias is completely surprised by this turn of events. But Napoleon very graciously, instead of having Sias imprisoned or killed, pensions him off to a chateau in the countryside with a very large sum of money. Napoleon's
not too shabby.
Really, he's not really vengeful. If you'll accept Napoleon as the dominant guy in the room, he's good with you. He's not going to be a vengeful. He's not vengeful, but he demands subordination.
Interesting. Let's continue our talk about how Napoleon changed France. And I'm interested in one of your books, which is titled The Great Demarcation, the French Revolution, and the Invention of Modern Property. Tell me about what you mean by that invention of modern property in that title, please.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, before the French Revolution, the category of property, what people in France considered to be property during the old regime, included things that we today would not consider to be property.
Like
public power, like a judgeship. So, for example, judgeships on the Supreme Courts of old regime France were hereditary property, passed down from father to son. They could be sold on the open marketplace. They literally have the status of property. There are other examples too. You've heard of the feudal system, of course.
Yeah. Well,
If you own a fief, if you own a seigneury, that's the term they used, that included not just ownership of land, but it also included ownership of the right to judge in court the criminal and civil cases of the people living on that land, just like the offices in the judicial offices. The fiefs and seigneuries could be bought, sold, just like property, inherited. And so, in other words, you could buy and sell public power. Public power was for sale.
Was that unique to France, or
it is particularly pronounced in France, but it is not unique to France. Other countries, including the colonial United States or pre-United States, colonial America, had elements of this too. The historian Gordon Wood has written extensively about this. The idea that to a certain extent, power and your public position were considered to be forms of property. This is a pre-modern, a kind of old regime European kind of norm. You can see it above all in kingship. Kings are seen as owners of their kingdoms. The sovereign is not just exercising a kind of abstract right of power over the people in his kingdom. He's actually owning the land in the kingdom as a property owner.
So the revenue of the state and the king's personal purse were one and the same in essence.
That's right. In fact, in countries like in England is this way for all of its moderate government and liberty. England to this very day, in England, the only person who is considered to be a full property owner in England right now is the monarch.
I didn't follow that sentence. Say that again. Property owner? What does that mean?
The only property owner, the only person in England today who owns outright, free and clear, owns outright, holds their property from nobody else, but owns it completely independently and fully, is the monarch.
How does that make sense? We were just in London this summer. If I buy a house in London, I've bought it. Who else owns it?
Well, you can buy it under two kinds of contract. You can buy it in a contract called leasehold, in which you are buying ownership of the house for a period of years, up to 999 years. Yes, many, 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 many properties in England are leasehold properties, so that at the end of that term, that property returns to its lord, who in many cases is the monarch.
Oh, wow.
So that's not full property. But then there's a more substantial kind of property right in England called freehold.
Yeah.
Where there's no term of years. It looks like full ownership of the property, except legally you are holding it from the crown.
Oh,
and it's free. It's called freehold because you're holding your property from the crown, but you are free of paying the crown any feudal obligations or services. But the basic fact is, in English law to this very day, the monarch is considered legally the lord and property holder of the entire land of England.
That is so interesting.
All European monarchies were like this a long time ago.
So how did he change property? We talked about this, public power. Was it a decree? That's a substantial change within a system, right?
Yeah, it's a massive change. But the French revolutionaries commit themselves to abolishing this kind of hierarchical form of property in which you hold your property from a superior. They commit to doing this in 1789. And what it's called, the kind of label that they give to that operation of turning this hierarchical dependent chain of property system into free and clear independent property that's beholden to no one, they call that the abolition of feudalism. That's what the abolition of feudalism is.
I see.
Feudalism is essentially a model of property owning, and that involves these hierarchical chains of holding, dependence, domination, and the French revolutionaries decide to abolish all that. And they do it. It's a very complicated system. It takes a long, long time. It's still not completely done, even by the time Napoleon is packed off to St. Helena. The process is finally completed in the mid-19th century.
It also gets rid of corruption in a big way.
Well, I mean,
introduces efficiencies and also, I guess, some sort of meritocracy.
That was one of the arguments for it, for trying to create free and clear, independently owned property. It was to give property owners an incentive to improve their lands.
I see.
It also had a political motivation, which is to allow citizens to be independent. The idea being that if you own your property free and clear and are not dependent on a superior lord, you can express your political will without any kind of constraint. You can express yourself freely. But if you are holding your property from a powerful lord and are dependent on that lord and have to pay that lord feudal dues and have to sit in the lord's court and be judged, are you really going to be have a free vote?
Or that's fascinating.
Under the influence of that proprietary superior.
That is interesting. You're right. We'll be back after a short break to talk about Napoleonic Wars. We'll be right back.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Blaufarb, there's a certain fascination with Napoleon and his battle genius that came much later in his career. Many people today, including those who know very little about Napoleon, sort of hold this romantic notion about the Napoleonic Wars. We think of them as sort of chivalrous, and they predate the industrial wars that came on later in the 19th century, such as the Franco-Prussian War or the U.S. Civil War. So my question is this: how unprecedented were the Napoleonic Wars?
Well, they were actually, let's just say, precedented. They were fought with exactly the same technology and tactics as previous wars in the 18th century had been fought.
Okay.
There's no technological innovation whatsoever. The standard weapon that soldiers are using is a smoothbore musket, and that particular weapon being relatively inaccurate and having relatively short range dictated a certain form of tactics, linear tactics, essentially to get the most out of that kind of weapon. Armies would form themselves up in long linear formations and essentially blaze away at each other at relatively short range with these wildly inaccurate weapons. But if you line up thousands of people all shooting in the same direction with these weapons, they're pretty formidable. So
you ought to hit something.
Yeah, exactly.
So rifles weren't invented then yet?
Rifles had been invented actually a long time earlier, uh-huh. But they were hunting weapons. The reason that rifles are not used on the battlefield is because they're expensive to make. They're a kind of more precision weapon. They're more expensive to make, and they also take an ungodly amount of time to reload. So a rifleman cannot get off a lot of shots. I don't know, maybe one shot every minute or two, whereas a musketeer can shoot three or four shots a minute.
I see. And with that number of people at that, you know, soldiers each side, you have a huge volley.
Exactly. So you think of the way I like to describe it to my class is to my students is that essentially the combination of the smoothbore musket and the linear formations, it turns battalions and regiments into collective human machine guns.
Wow. Okay. So technologically, it was precedented. Was the scale of the warfare unprecedented?
That's what's unprecedented.
There you go.
The number of soldiers involved in these wars was far more than Europe and possibly anywhere in the world up to that point had ever seen. These are probably, the Napoleonic Wars are, I believe, the largest wars in human history until World War I. They dwarf the Civil War. Yes. They are enormous. And but to be fair to the French Revolution, not to give Napoleon credit for things he didn't invent, it's actually the French Revolution that pioneers this new kind of mass army.
How so?
In 1793, at the height of the revolution, at the height of revolutionary radicalism and instability, France is being invaded from all sides by pretty much every country in Europe. And it's very survival. The revolution's very survival is at stake. The revolutionary government responds by decreeing a levy en masse. It is essentially mobilizing every single male subject between the ages of 25 and 40 for potential service in the army. On paper, the levy en masse produces an army of 1.2 million soldiers. In reality, it's more like 750,000 who actually turn up. But
that's still a lot.
It is a lot, especially when you consider that the largest army Europe had seen before that date had been the armies of Louis XIV, nearly 100 years earlier. And Louis XIV had only managed to mobilize about 400,000 soldiers. So we're talking the French Revolution doubles or triples the previous record as far as army size. And Napoleon just continues this tradition.
So if we're talking about these huge numbers, then, and I don't want to get into statistics or anything, the scale of death and destruction must have also been to some extent unprecedented.
Yeah, I think it probably was. And interestingly, I think it's the numbers that kind of encourage a greater level of death and destruction. The reason is this. When Napoleon comes to power, France is putting in place, has just begun to put in place, a permanent system of conscription so that every year the government can call up tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of young men to fill the ranks, the depleted ranks of its armies.
Mm-hmm.
For a general and statesman like Napoleon, who realizes, wow, every year I can get, like, say, 200,000 more soldiers if I need them, it encourages him to be less than economical with the lives of his soldiers on the battlefield, because he knows they can all be replaced. And in fact, after his early brilliant victories, culminating in the 1805-1806 Austerlitz campaign and the campaign against Prussia, Napoleon increasingly turns to, relies on direct frontal assaults by essentially human wave assaults by vast conscript armies of cannon fodder that he simply throws at the enemy again and again and again, replacing them year after year after year with conscription. But his battlefield finesse is kind of diminishes as he turns more and more to, like, mass tactics that ultimately rest on the cheapness and the easy availability of human life.
That's so tragic.
Yeah.
Wow. he goes from military brilliance to sort of brute force. You know, in the first segment, we were talking about his roots, his back to Corsica. I'm not drawing a parallel to Hitler or anything like that. I'm just fascinated by the fact that how Hitler was also not German, yet he led Germans into war. Is that something that you've ever thought about?
About Napoleon? Well, I think that by the time he's actually leading armies, he's French now. He has become French. One of the, whether willingly or not, is a question. But the fact is that in 1793, Napoleon and his entire family are forced to flee Corsica.
Hopefully.
They're driven out of the island. They're actually being threatened with violence by rival Corsican factions that oppose the French Revolution and generally oppose France. Well, the Bonaparte family, as I had mentioned earlier in our interview, had gotten in bed with the French regime right after the conquest, and then got connected to the French Revolution. And so in Corsica itself, the Bonapartes are seen as traitors. They are seen as traitors, and they have to flee.
Interesting.
The entire family flees, and basically Napoleon doesn't come back to Corsica in his lifetime.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Blaufarb as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Blaufarb, in your opinion, why are the French so upset about the recent film Napoleon? And you mentioned Joaquin Phoenix in the earlier episodes as well, earlier segments as well.
Well, I've looked at some of the reactions by my colleagues, by my French historian friends, and there seem to be two schools of thought. The most vocal criticism is that the portrayal of Napoleon and his doings is anti-French. It really does not paint Napoleon in a particularly favorable light. That stretches from the portrayal by Joaquin Phoenix, a kind of lurking, sinister, unattractive character with like no real charisma or brilliance or much of anything, to the absences in the film. There's no mention of any of Napoleon's accomplishments, such as ending the French Revolution, preserving equality, building lasting institutions based on equality, and laying the groundwork for France's 19th century prosperity. Things like that aren't even mentioned. And so some of my colleagues find the film to be a typically anti-French, English-produced work.
I love it. You know, the way you set up their point of view, it does make the film look one-sided.
Yeah, but you know, there is another school of thought, and this is the one that I subscribe to. I've heard it most articulately advanced by the dean of Napoleonic Studies, a really eminent scholar, Jean Toulard. Toulard is interesting because not only is he the leading historian of Napoleon in the world, but also he is an extremely accomplished film historian.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. And so he has all of the qualifications. And interestingly, his criticism doesn't really get too upset about this, the supposed anti-French message of the film. He just thinks it's a terrible film. He thinks that the script is awful. I think it's a terrible script. The script is awful and the casting is abysmal because the acting is terrible.
So you share his opinion?
Absolutely. And he has reviewed in great detail the many Napoleon films that have been written, I'm a historian, I speak that way, I think that way. The many films that have been produced about Napoleon, and he's reviewed the different Napoleons, and he finds the Joaquin Phoenix Napoleon to be absolutely like bottom of the barrel.
Oh boy.
Very unconvincing, just strangely unconvincing.
It's got low reviews as well and Rotten Tomatoes and all of that. Yeah.
Unfortunately for Napoleonic scholars like myself, we were hoping for a kind of windfall of interest in students, but oh well.
Yeah. Not that it matters, but I have to share this. I couldn't get anyone to go see the film with me. So they're like, no, it's got low reviews. You mentioned your colleagues, then you mentioned the Dean of Napoleonic Studies. And I'm curious about your own institute. Can you tell us about the Institute on Napoleon and the French Revolution that you are the head of?
Yes, it's a unit within the Florida State University History Department.
Mm-hmm.
Its mission, it was founded in 1990 by the Board of Governors of Florida, of the state of Florida. Its mission is purely graduate education. What it does is it supervises and encourages graduate work, master's degrees and PhDs on Napoleonic and French Revolutionary history. Over the years since 1990, it has produced, I hate to use that word when talking about students, human beings, but it has produced something like 50 master's degrees and maybe 50 or more doctoral degrees, and its alumni teach all over the United States.
How did this focus on Napoleonic studies develop in Florida State University?
Well, what happened was one of the members of the history department, Dr. Don Horward, recently deceased. Dr. Don Horward was just a member of the faculty of the history department, but he was extremely passionate about Napoleon, and he was an extremely gifted, persuasive, charismatic organizer, as well as a fantastic teacher and lecturer.
Yeah.
And he had a kind of force of character and the personality means to achieve his vision, and his vision was to set up a center of Napoleonic studies, his passion, at the university where he taught. And by dint of will and charisma and a whole lot of effort, many hundreds of letters and meetings with people, he finally managed to get this institute set up. It's very hard to get anything set up in a university. They were very slow-moving bureaucracies. But Horward managed to do this. And I am fortunate to have inherited the directorship of the institute he created. I'm its second director. He was the first for many years, and it's a fantastic, unique institution. It is literally the only institute in the United States where you can specifically get a degree, a graduate degree in Napoleonic and Revolutionary Studies.
I know when I was researching a guest for this program, you're the top person that I thought of, and I'm very delighted that you joined our program. I literally noticed that this is the only institution of its kind in the United States, and that fascinated me, hence my question. Is there a museum attached to this institute?
Initially, there were all kinds of plans for museums and whatnot, but that never happened, which in some ways is a good thing. Because it means that instead of the Napoleon and French Revolution Institute being off somewhere in its own palatial building, separate from the general life of the history department, it is actually integrated participates in the general history department. And that means that the graduate students who are in the Napoleon Institute are full-fledged members of the Florida State history community, instead of being off in a kind of gilded ghetto somewhere, isolated from their colleagues, maybe looked upon with jealousy by their peers. It's a much better, I think it's much better that the Institute remained focused on academia and didn't try to branch out into things like collecting museums, exhibitions, libraries.
That makes sense. Let's close our conversation, Dr. Flaubert, by going back to the movie. And specifically, I want to go to something you said, Napoleon's accomplishments. and how it didn't come across. It wasn't shown in the movie. So what is Napoleon's legacy?
Well, he has several legacies. The main one, the reason why there's a movie at all about Napoleon, in fact, the reason why there's so many movies about Napoleon, is his reputation. He forged a lasting reputation, a lasting image that was really quite unique, a kind of the image of a self-made hero who rose from nothing to the greatest heights of power, glory, and brilliance. There's a lot of truth to that that image, but there's also a lot of deliberate curating on Napoleon's part. But that is the lasting image. It's not so much that Napoleon was brilliant, great, and magnificent. It's the rags to riches element to that.
Yeah.
That he rose from nothingness, and he created that kind of model for people to aspire to.
But that nothingness, that could be his propaganda, because as I understand it, his family was relatively well off in Corsica, right?
That's correct. The Bonapartes, they were relatively minor nobles by the standards of the royal court of France.
Yeah.
But by the standards of Corsica, they were very important local power players.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but he was able to curate that image to make it sound like he came from nothing, rags to riches. Dr. Blau Farb, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. I loved it.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past, rather, is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.